Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Jennifer Ackerman. Today, I'm reading from the November and December editions of National Geographic magazine. We begin with an article written by Ronan O'Connell titled 1,300-Year-Old Silken Treasure. One of China's most revered ancient art forms is being embraced by the country's youth. Flames, beasts, weapons, and stars flow from wooden looms to embellish brocade, a 1,300-year-old fabric once reserved for China's elite and now popular with young fashion designers. This art form is so complex that even veteran craftspeople produce only about 2 inches of textile a day. Traditional looms can be 18 feet long, have thousands of parts, and require dozens of steps to operate by artisans who sing ballads to memorize the process. From this creative matrix emerges luminous cloth with patterns woven from silk, gold, and peacock feather yarn. Brocade emerged in China during the Tang Dynasty, AD 618 to 907. Regional varieties developed across the country, including in Nanjing and Chengdu, home to silk museums where tourists can now buy authentic brocade scarves and bags. The complicated fabric cannot be replicated by factories. It can be woven only on the traditional loom, says Fang Zhao, honorary director of the China National Silk Museum in Hangzhou. This authenticity appeals to older Chinese people who appreciate brocade from their hearts, Zhao says, and view it as a proud symbol of cultural heritage. And increasingly, up-and-coming Chinese fashion creators are collaborating with traditional weavers to emblazon garments with symbols such as phoenixes, clouds, and dragons. Designer Chen Luwen last year launched a range of scarves and accessories targeted at Gen Z consumers that feature the Hubu tiger pattern. Ancient brocade, then, seems tightly threaded into China's future. And that concludes the article written by Ronan O'Connell, titled 1,300-Year-Old Silken Treasure. Our next article is written by Tara Roberts, titled Charleston Reconsidered. With the opening of a long-awaited museum on a historic wharf, this southern city is reconnecting with its coastline and reckoning with its tragic past. At last count, there were more than 100 African-American museums around the United States, all collecting and preserving the history of people of African descent. The biggest and most comprehensive of all, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, sits on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. But the June 27th opening of the International African American Museum, the IAAM, in Charleston, South Carolina, is particularly significant. The museum is located on Gadsden's Wharf, which from 1783 to 1807 was the largest single point of entry into North America for enslaved Africans. More than 40% of all captive Africans were brought to the U.S. here, where they were sold into slavery at auction. They were then sent on to plantations and farms across the country. In the late 1700s, Gadsden's Wharf stretched 840 feet across, about 3 city blocks, and could accommodate up to 6 ships at once. Each one carried a cargo hold full of as many as a few hundred captive Africans. It's estimated that more than 80% of all African Americans can trace at least one ancestor to the area. The site choice and the nearly $100 million investment of the building of the IAAM are also part of a larger reckoning happening in Charleston. In 2015, the Confederate flag was removed from the South Carolina State House. In 2018, the City Council formally apologized for Charleston's role in slavery. And the city has begun to challenge the mainstream narrative around the nature of plantations, with their deep-set porches, grand columns, and often beautifully cultivated land. But many plantation grounds still include unmarked graves where the enslaved were buried. McLeod Plantation is one of the rare plantations in the country that focus on accounts of the enslaved who toiled in the heat and cold for no pay and little rest, often under brutal conditions. This place is a memorial to the life and the times of those who were enslaved here but retained their humanity, says Toby Smith, the Cultural History Interpretation Coordinator for Charleston County Parks and Recreation, which operates McLeod. This is their moment to be honored and to be lifted up and to be learned from. While IAAM broadly explores the history of African Americans and the global legacy of the transatlantic slave trade, it also tells the story of Black South Carolinians, and specifically of the Gullah Geechees, a unique people who have traditionally resided in the coastal areas and the sea islands of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. Because they were enslaved on isolated islands and coastal plantations, they are one of a few groups of African Americans to retain foods, language, culture, and traditions that can be traced directly back to Africa. Tia Clark, who founded the top-rated travel experience Casual Crabbing with Tia in 2018, says she's excited to visit IAAM, but I know it's going to be super emotional for me. Clark is of Gullah Geechee heritage, and her family once lived in downtown Charleston on Henrietta Street. But Clark says she grew up ashamed of her background. "I turned my back on my heritage because I thought it was bad," she says. Then 6 years ago, a cousin took her crabbing for the first time, and she said it was like a baptism and a reawakening. It reconnected her to the culture of her ancestors, who used to crab for sustenance. This brought her back to the water, something she didn't even know she was missing. Now she teaches tourists and even locals how to fish for crab in Charleston Harbor. And she herself spends hours out there, casting her net, often in the wee hours of the morning, watching the sunrise, reclaiming the parts of herself that were once lost. Even though the story of African Americans starts on faraway shores, one chapter begins on arrival on these shores, along this coastline, in the water. "It's that water that brought the Africans here," says Smith, who was also Gullah Geechee. "And as Gullah people, the water, we believe, carries our souls to rest." Maybe, ultimately, the most surprising and profound thing about IAAM is that by standing at the edge of this historic wharf, it helps bring African Americans back to the ocean, back to the turbulent Atlantic, back to a place of origin, death, sustenance, and now, self-healing. And that concludes the article titled "Charleston Reconsidered," written by Tara Roberts. Our last article in the November edition is "Building on New Soil." In 2000, photographer John Lowenstein met a gutsy Mexican transplant named Guadalupe. At the time, Lupe was struggling to raise her family in a tough section of Chicago. Lowenstein became an honorary member of the family. Here, he shares a selection of their trials and triumphs, while writer Luis Alberto Urrea brings us along to a recent family celebration, a rich glimpse into the heart of the immigrant experience. It's an American dream. These immigrants traveled across the continent and settled on the prairies. They prospered from working hard 7 days a week and came to live in this ranch house west of Chicago. Today's the birthday party for one of the moms. Two cakes, Mylar balloons, women in the kitchen, and the men still at work. Shiny cardboard letters spell out "Happy Birthday" on the living room wall. Children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews run the hallway and jump on the couches. The laughter spills outdoors. This home on the Illinois prairie sits on the communal land of several nations. Ojibwa, Potawatomi, and Odawa families have roots here. Long ago, the county two-lane might have been a wagon path, a dirt trail that hosted pilgrims and vagabonds heading west. Perhaps they were escaping the mosquito-plagued marshlands of the Chicago Lakeshore, a place whose name and the language of the indigenous Miami, Illinois, refers to an odorous wild garlic plant. Those who stopped here knew a good thing when they saw it. Out there, across the road, a sea of cornstalks waves beneath a setting orange sun. The single streetlight on its tall stanchion comes to life and makes the nearest corn glow. Afternoon crows fly to the autumn trees and nearby silos and barns. Cows in the distance low mournfully. Dogs bark. Off to the side of the house, machines for working the land rest on the grass. The backyard, hidden by a tall suburban fence, holds a pool and a compact playground, but nobody dares enter because the watchdog bites everybody who comes through the gate, except for the visiting grandmother, who has the dog-whispering mojo and the stern demeanor of an empress. Inside the house, there's always coffee ready for whatever traveler or laborer comes through the door, which never seems to be locked. In the kitchen, Donna Rosa cooks for her daughter Gabriella, Gabby, and Gabby's husband, Salvador, Chava. Chava is still at work, leading his crew of landscapers through their appointments for fall cleanups. Donna Rosa has traveled by plane from Acapulco for Gabby's birthday party. As more and more people arrive for the celebration, the driveway fills with pickup trucks and minivans. Photographer John Lowenstein leads the way into the house. I feel uneasy, invading their celebration day, but Lowenstein is unstoppable and seems to be a de facto member of the family. "Hola, John," voices call from the kitchen. He has been photographing the family for 20 years, attending births and parties and tragedies for them for so long they don't even notice his restless camera or its hunger. The focus of consternation at the moment is me. This is a private day, and they don't know what my agenda might be. A writer? A writer of what? How can they know I want to simply bask, to go home to a house that no longer exists, to a language I seldom hear? Not Spanish, but small-town Spanish. Rancho and Pueblo and garden Spanish. The delicious steam in the kitchen, the scent of Mexican rice and refried beans, takes me back to 1963, to my godmother's kitchen where no one ever spoke English. Though they tried, launching American phrases like, "How are you?" which always came out as, "Favuju." The women in the kitchen are welcoming, of course. Perhaps no one is as polite and generous as working-class people from villages and the heartland of Mexico. We are invited to sit. Bottles of the soft drink squirt and glasses of water appear as if by magic. El squirt es muy bueno. Sí, sí, I enthuse. Coffee immediately lands before us. Bottles of water crowd out the glasses because they're more special than tap water. Fruit juice. And an order. You must eat. When I introduce myself in Spanish, the household unfolds all its petals open to the sun. ¿Hablas español como un mexicano? You speak Spanish like a Mexican? Soy un mexicano. I am Mexican. Handshakes are out of the question now. It's all hugs and laughter. I wish Gabby a happy birthday. She pats my back, tightens her apron, and gets back to work. Over her shoulder, she says, "Sit." Donna Rosa suddenly drops her guard and moves her meal construction project to the table where I'm sitting, and then sets up shop beside me. Thus, she announces her blessing. A pan holds marinated meat. It looks as rich as chocolate. Donna Rosa moves fast, her hands doing fascinating culinary origami. She's preparing a traditional meal from her home state of Guerrero, a meal as ancient as the Chichimec tribe and possibly never seen in this part of Illinois. The closest one could get to describing it would be tamales, but only if you were to toss away the masa and the corn husks. She wraps the marinated meat in banana leaves, then binds the tight packages in aluminum foil, a nod to modernity, and places them in steamers. Her eyes seem calibrated. She pulls the exact size of meat for the banana leaf set before her. These packets are piled atop cauldrons of boiling water on shiny grates. The aroma inhabits the space with its ancient incense. Banana leaves keep the flavor in, Donna Rosa says. She is proud of the tenderness of her dish. You need good, strong flavor. It soaks into the meat, and my sauce can seep into the carne, too. But nobody here can make it. You don't have banana trees here. We ponder how sad this is as Gabby brings more coffee, and I feel embarrassed that she's tending on me. Lowenstein has vanished. I'm on my own. I brought the leaves with me, Donna Rosa explains. The airline didn't think anything of it, she shrugs. I suppose I don't look like a bad guy, she says, giving me the side eye. The thought of Donna Rosa being an outlawed drug smuggler makes Gabby laugh as she chops cilantro and onions behind the veil of steam. Gracias a Dios, she sighs, her regular praise of the Lord. Later in the night, she will unleash deeply satisfying strings of obscenities directed at a bad dog. My love grows deeper. Lowenstein reappears from some clandestine mission down the long hall. He takes pictures of Gabby's hands, of the leaves, the pots, the passing kids, of the vicious little dog come from no one knows whence that has begun a military assault on the ankles of everyone who is not a child. "I, Cajon," Donna Rosa says, ignoring the persistent photographer while shaking her head in the slightly fierce way of a Mexican grandmother who hides her delight. "Es tremendo. He's something else." Gabby works diligently in and around her mother as nieces and daughters flow through the kitchen and up and down the halls, all of them on hilarious intrigues. One wall is festooned with balloons and crepe. Donna Rosa approves of my presence enough to try to teach me how to wrap the meat like a good citizen of the state of Guerrero, which she is proud to remind me stands for warrior. Although everybody is watchful, Chava, the son-in-law, is about to arrive. The strength of the Mexican family holds fast through its women. Elders are the current that carries history and legend and tradition to these distant riverbanks of life. The women let the men strut and rule, but they know all the secrets and arrange for the stage to allow the patriarch's displays. Gabby keeps offering me food. I try to avoid being a burden, but the women are offended. They can't believe I don't want rice and beans or fresh tortillas. I'm embarrassed to be served or fussed over. In the living room, the TV is always on, and an army of small kids gathers on the couches and ottomans or suddenly barrels through the thickening forest of adults to charge up and down the halls. Little polyglot girls hold up stuffed animals and make announcements in their indecipherable inner languages. I notice that the dominant tones and words from English are already crowding out the Spanish music among some of the younger generation. Several of the young ones seem unable to speak Spanish, or perhaps they don't want to. Todo cambia, Donna Rosa says. Everything changes. Note to readers, every Mexican grandmother is a philosopher. The teens and young adults enjoy the dark living room and whisper secrets as the kids laugh at the shenanigans of an old SpongeBob cartoon. Elizabeth and Betsa have great plans for their future lives. Somebody's pregnant. I think her husband is with her. The young women are dressed to kill. Suddenly, here comes Chava, the master of the house. The kids part. He kisses his wife, nods at Lowenstein, and turns a skeptical eye on me. Lowenstein says, I'm a writer. What do you write? Chava asks, sitting down at the head of the table. Everything. Books. Books about what? It feels like a test from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. If I answer incorrectly, I might fly through the roof. But Gabby intervenes with tactically delivered food, steaming gorgeously before Chava. Gracias. He looks around to see if Lowenstein is going to torment him as he eats. It's evident right away that he's not all that comfortable being photographed. He still seems bemused by my place at the table. He shakes my hand. You look like an American, he says. He tests my Spanish, a subtle entrance exam. He quickly relaxes. This universal test is simple. Either you pass or you do not. It isn't even what you say, it's the way you say it. It's musical, and it has the element of ballet. You can't do New York gestures, you have to do Mexican gestures. If you have to ask, you've already failed the exam. His handsome son, Chava Jr., appears from down the hall. Chava and Chava sit together and stare at me. "Aren't you eating?" Chava numero uno asks. "Why isn't he eating?" Chava numero dos asks. "No sé, I don't know." Chava one looks deep into the kitchen with his eyebrows and asks, "What's the problem?" Gabby comes to the table. "Don't you like my cooking?" "I offered him rice," her daughter calls, "and he refused." "You don't like rice?" Chava one asks. "I love rice." "Why don't you like rice?" Chava two demands. "I was trying not to be a bother." "Bring him rice," Chava one orders. Gabby puts a plate of rice in front of me. "Just rice? What kind of meal is that? Don't you like beans?" Chava one asks. "Why don't you like beans?" Chava two adds. "I thought you were Mexican," Chava one adds. "I am," I sputter. "I do. Bring them beans then." They add beans to my plate. "Why are you eating that with a fork? Don't you like tortillas?" Chava two holds his tortilla in his hand and looks at me with bewilderment. Chava one flips the cloth back on his basket, revealing a stack of hot corn tortillas. I take one. "Mmm," I overreact. "Maize." Donna Rosa comments, in passing, "He doesn't seem to like the meat I made." Where is Lowenstein? Meat descends from above and behind like a drooling UFO. Now my plate is full of food, a monument of steamed banana leaf meat extravaganza and a valley of rice. Chava one says, "What's wrong? Don't you like the salsa we eat?" One of the men, gradually collecting at the dining room table, tells me, "Spanish, it's like a vacation, isn't it? Like a visit with our mothers and fathers." The women of the family continue serving the table with no rest, and they scold anyone who's not eating their food. Music plays. Earlier in the day, when the women in the kitchen were in charge, it was traditional Mexican music. Now that the kids are filling the living room and spilling down the hall into the mysterious rooms back there, it becomes dance music and hip-hop and Bad Bunny, the Puerto Rican rapper. Lowenstein, the terrorist with the camera, is dancing up and down the hall. Every now and then, someone shuffles along with him, but often he's dancing only with his camera, clicking from the hip, from the shoulder, over his shoulder, occasionally carefully aimed. Interpretive camera dance, shooting by instinct. The family doesn't see him. He has become one of their tribe, but I notice that none of them call him Juan. Gabby, the birthday celebrant, says, "Poor John, he shoots thousands of pictures. Aren't rolls of film expensive? We must have cost him a fortune." She hasn't quite processed his explanations of the digital era. "Oh, well, I need to shower," she adds. "I need to fix myself for the party. I need to be glamorous." Donna Rosa says, "John keeps taking pictures of me in a smock and apron. We both need to primp." He snaps a birthday portrait of the three of us in the kitchen, and I suddenly feel like I'm Bigfoot, towering over two diminutive and very serious campers. After Donna Rosa and Gabby leave to shower and dress for the evening festivities, my new friend Zenon sits with me. It's a miracle of Spanish that as soon as you share the language, you are brothers, unless you seem to not like the beans. Zenon is a fountain of kind energy. He notices my Alaska baseball cap. "Have you been to Alaska?" he asks. I nod. "Is it attached to America?" "Yes." "Is it far?" "Oh, yes." "Mountains?" "Many mountains." He seems wistful. "I want to see mountains, but I will not find them in Illinois." "No. I went to the west of Illinois. They had some little mountains, but I didn't like the river." "The Mississippi?" "See, it was brown. That big river, it was dirty." I blurt in my joy, "It flows all the way to Louisiana." "Is that in the United States?" "Anyway, I went to Wisconsin for work, but no mountains there either. Maybe Indiana? They have casinos in Indiana," he says, brightening. Lowenstein announces that these parties typically go till 6 a.m. Gabby, in her pretty flowered birthday dress, nods. She takes a place at the gift table beneath the balloon arch, and the singing begins. It has been a few weeks since the birthday party, and several members of the family have been struck with a mystery illness, coughing, exhaustion, not apparently COVID. Even the powerful Donna Lupe is in bed. But we drive to her home to see her famous elote cart, the miraculous wheeled cart that corn sellers push through every border town. Hers is parked in front of her row house, like a monument. A drive around the block tells the story of emigration to Chicago. A rough-looking old apartment, then a house. An elote cart, then around the corner, a swap meet where Donna Lupe organized and made a financial opening for others, regardless of immigration status. Then, around the corner and up the street, neat bungalows where later generations live. They include young people like Elizabeth, Eli, the first in her family to attend college. The entire tale in one short paragraph. Lowenstein and I collect Eli and head back west to the cornfields and the house that hosted the birthday party. When we get there, the place is quiet. Even the mighty Don Chava is ill. He had a terrible headache, and Gabby put him to bed. The little ones are still in evidence, though the volume is greatly reduced. Donna Rosa sits with me at the table and talks to me as if I were her nephew. Tales of gardens and families and homelands and narcos. If they know you, they are the best people to know because they protect you. If they don't know you, it's not so good. Gabby sits with us, relaxed. We are suddenly part of a fabulous Spanish term, entre familia, among family. Everybody is sad that Donna Rosa is flying to Utah, especially Xenon, who heard that Utah has mountains. Donna Rosa has family there, too. She wants to see them all before the awful cold and snow hit Chicago. She wants Eli to come, but Eli has a job. I worked hard this week, Gabby says. Here? No, I work with the yard crew. I blow the air, blow the leaves. Everybody works, Donna Rosa says. Gracias a Dios, Gabby replies. As we leave, she gives me a full meal wrapped in foil for my wife and two slices of birthday cake from our party. When you come back, bring her. She's family now. We have parties every Saturday, and then we can have breakfast. The fat sun wobbles over the cornfields as we head home, peaceful as a painting, an American Vesta. And that concludes the article titled Building on New Soil, written by Luis Alberto Urrea. That's it for this edition of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the November edition of National Geographic Magazine. I'm Jennifer Ackerman. So long till next time.